Live here on KCPW, I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a conversation with Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic who earlier this week published an article entitled Take the Shutdown Skeptics Seriously. This is not a straightforward battle between a pro-human and a pro-economy camp. That's coming up just a little bit later on the show, but first, in light of calls to immediately and completely reopen the economy, we checked in this week with state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn on the impact the public health response to this pandemic is having on our economic system. At the beginning of this month, Utah moved from red level to orange level. That is to say, it adjusted its coronavirus risk level from high to moderate. A couple of weeks back on this show, we examined what that meant in terms of business openings and whether even making that move was a good idea at this point in the pandemic. You can find that at kcpw.org. Fast forward to last week when a Utah lawmaker, Clearfield Republican Representative Paul Ray, via a Facebook post shared more than 1,300 times, added his voice to that end of the spectrum calling for a full and immediate opening of the economy. In his post, Ray said that policy in Utah was being driven by media and panic. He compared the coronavirus pandemic to the seasonal flu to back up his arguments. And he said, essentially, that crippling the economy to deal with the pandemic wasn't worth it. This week, during one of the near-daily updates from Utah's COVID-19 Community Task Force, I asked state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn about some of those arguments, including the impact of the lockdowns on our economic system. And here's what she said.
So we can't separate the public health crisis from the economic crisis. They go hand in hand. This is, of course, first a health crisis. We certainly can't just open up the economy if people feel scared to go out and they don't even go to a restaurant. So we need to make sure that we're containing the virus enough so that the public has confidence that they can go out safely and not get infected. We at the health department are acutely aware of the impact of economic strain on the health of individuals and families, potentially for generations to come. So this is something we are certainly striving to end this pandemic as quickly as possible to limit that economic hardship. Again, we don't see these as two competing priorities. It's something we have to address together and moving hand in hand as we move forward in this pandemic response. I know that our case counts have been low and our death rates have been low because we've taken very early and proactive responses here in Utah to prevent the spread of COVID-19. And we're in a good space because of that. And it's allowing us to creatively open up our economy in kind of the slow roll way to ensure that we consistently balance the health and the economics of this. So we're doing the right thing here in Utah, and I'm confident that we'll be able to manage both the health and the economic side moving forward.
So balancing economic and public health concerns, which Dunn says do not exist in a vacuum and are not at odds with each other. That's what state leaders are trying to do with what they say is a measured response. Another argument some proponents of reopening everything have made is that the novel coronavirus is essentially akin to the seasonal flu, and that that's how we should be treating it. I asked Dr. Dunn about that as well.
Just in terms of how contagious this is and in terms of how deadly it is as compared to the flu, can you address that part of Representative Ray's claims?
So it's really not comparing apples to apples. COVID-19, of course, is caused by a novel virus that we do not have treatment for. We do not have a vaccine against. For flu, we both have a vaccine and treatment for. We also can't predict COVID-19 and how it's going to spread and who it's going to impact in the same way that we can predict our annual flu epidemic. We've had annual flu epidemics for decades, so we're good at being able to predict it. Even though we can predict our flu epidemic every year, it still annually causes a strain on our hospitals and our ICU. So those are the best case scenarios. You've got the flu that has a vaccine and treatment, and we can predict it, yet it still strains our healthcare systems every single year during flu season. With COVID, we don't have a vaccine, we don't have treatment, and we can't predict it. So it's something that we have to take these social distancing measures in order to really prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Again, that's state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn responding to my questions about calls for completely reopening Utah during this pandemic. As new information comes to light, we'll keep revisiting where local public health officials and political leaders stand on the measures being taken to address our new pandemic reality. Now on the show, though, we're going to turn to a different conversation. On Tuesday of this week, the magazine The Atlantic published an article entitled "Take the Shutdown Skeptics Seriously. This is not a straightforward battle between a pro-human and a pro-economy camp." The author was Atlantic staff writer Connor Friedersdorf, and yesterday I got him on a Zoom call to dig into what he had written. Connor Friedersdorf, thanks very much for making time for this today.
My pleasure.
You wrote a more nuanced article about the calls to reopen than I have seen in many places, and you lay out the supposed debate that is happening between lives and the economy. And just to be clear, that's how this debate is being framed by a lot of people, right? The idea that we are we're taking actions that are depressing the economy in the name of lives, and that's basically the only calculus that's being made, correct?
Yeah, a lot of people are talking as if that's the case, and I just think it's a lot more complicated than that.
You wrote, "Set aside flattening the curve, which will continue to make sense. Are ongoing onerous shutdowns warranted beyond what is necessary to avoid overwhelming ambulances, hospitals, and morgues?" And you say the answer depends in part on an unknown, how close the country is to containing the virus. Can you just explain that, kind of walk us through that, Connor?
Yes. You know, I'm staying home right now. I am staying away from people. I'm being very cautious. And part of the reason I'm doing that is because I think it could be that in the next few weeks, we get a treatment for COVID-19 that's more effective. I would much rather get it 6 months from now than today, because doctors are doing all of these clinical trials. Perhaps some of the antiviral medicines that they're testing will come through. And so if you're an optimist, then delaying the infections until a time when we have a vaccine or a better treatment, it makes sense to do that. On the other hand, we don't know for sure that we're going to get a better treatment. We don't know for sure that we're going to get a vaccine. And so it could be the case that at the other extreme end of the spectrum, we never get these things. And we simply, delaying cases now only delays the inevitable. We're going to get it. We're going to do how we do with our immune system. And so in that case, onerous shutdowns wouldn't make nearly as much sense if we were just delaying the inevitable at great economic cost, at great cost to people with other diseases who aren't getting treated in hospitals now, at great cost to the supply chain. Who knows what this will do to, one thing I mentioned in my article is starvation in third world countries. You know, the supply chain is good enough in the United States that we're probably all going to have enough food to eat. But what does it do to places that are right on the edge of starvation? And so every wrinkle that you think of, it just gets more complicated in terms of what actually saves more lives in the long run.
The two, you sort of laid out these two competing polarized potentials. You just described one of them, which is that conceivably we're not going to have, we don't know, there's this uncertainty and we don't know whether or not a vaccine will be found, and we don't know if we're going to find a way out of this. I guess that part, that aspect of it, feels very pessimistic. The idea that we're not going to find a way out of this, that there won't be a vaccine found after a lot of effort and a lot of money being spent digging into this novel coronavirus and trying to find a way to, a silver bullet, so to speak. That argument doesn't seem like it's the argument that's being made by the majority of the shutdown skeptics that are out there either. Do you think that we should be scared that science won't find a way out of this, that medical researchers won't find a way out of this? Or is that just a different sort of possible scenario that you're considering?
Well, I'm hopeful. I think we should be hopeful. I think we're throwing more resources at finding a vaccine for this than probably any disease in history. At the same time, it isn't so long ago that we witnessed the onset of the HIV epidemic, and it took quite a while for treatments for HIV to improve. They did eventually, but we were talking about a decade before that happened or more. And we still don't have an HIV vaccine. We still don't have a herpes vaccine. There are lots of viruses for which there is no vaccine. So it wouldn't be unprecedented if we could not find a vaccine. And, there's never been a vaccine for a coronavirus. The quickest we've ever done this is, I think people talk about 4 years for the vaccine for Ebola. The idea that we're definitely going to have one in a year or 18 months, I think that that's too optimistic.
you know, you compiled some of the arguments in the meantime, and you've already mentioned a couple of them, but that are being made about how the economics of the intentional shutdown that we're having, that will have, you know, its own impact on human lives. Can you walk us just through a few of those? I mean, you talked about the third world starvation scenario, but there are others that are being made closer to home about an economic depression and its impact on people's well-being and even mortality rates.
Sure. I mean, you know, it seems as though economic hardship is associated with a spike in deaths from opiates, for example. And we see a lot of people dying, you know, tens of thousands of people dying in the United States every year from opiate addiction. You know, if that were to meaningfully go up, if drug deaths were meaningfully to go up, that would be a big deal. Suicides are a big cause of death. And if something about the combination of losing your job and also having to isolate yourself from all of your loved ones caused more people to commit suicide, that would be worth thinking about. You know, people are not going to doctors to get their normal checkups. They're not getting their cancer screenings. People with kids aren't going in and getting them inoculated against other things like measles. And, you know, these other diseases kill people. So there's all sorts of other downstream consequences to declining to do the things that we were doing for good reasons before.
You also wrote about another one of those things was the economic underpinnings of the health system itself. That, you know, masks and personal protective equipment and all the rest of it are made by companies that participate in the global economy. Can you sort of describe that?
Yeah, you know, lots of the most ambitious responses to this pandemic, from the massive government bailouts of industry to the increased payments to individuals to purchasing lots of protective equipment for doctors and nurses, to some of the proposals for testing millions and millions of people, you know, these things all require money. We are able to pay for these things in a way that less wealthy countries are not, because we have lots of money, because we have a well-functioning economy that generates a lot of wealth. And so we can't just shut that down and not have that wealth and still buy all of the healthcare goods or all of the cut all of the unemployment checks. You know, there's some limit to the deficits that we can run. And it may be a big limit, and it may be that we can stretch for a couple of years, and maybe we can stretch for much longer than most countries. But still, there is a limit, and it's important to bear this in mind. And I want to emphasize that none of this means that lifting restrictions now is necessarily the right call. It could be that we'll see a spike in deaths that is so big that it overwhelms all of these other factors. It could be that we ought to lift restrictions now, but with very strict mask rules of a kind that Americans may or may not follow. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. And so I want to emphasize that I'm not coming down in favor of any solution. I wish I knew what the solution was. I would tell you if I did.
I mean, yeah, the thing that the public health officials frequently point to is the fact that the measures that we have taken so far is the reason we're not seeing the kinds of death counts that, you know, you could expect to otherwise have had we not taken any precautions to flatten the curve and so on and so forth. So that's another kind of unknowable thing, right? Like if we had just let this thing run its course, there may have been a lot more dire consequences or outcomes. Is that something that you accept? Or that, I mean, you wrote an article compiling a lot of information from various people who were making these arguments. And I know, I hear you, you aren't specifically saying that you know, but just in terms of, you know, the fact that there are public health officials out there who point to the reasons we're taking these measures being something that is knowable, which is the contagion rate and the mortality rate of the virus.
Oh, yeah. You know, when these measures were first put into place, I thought on balance that they were probably a good idea. I think we know a bit more information now than we did then. We know the kinds of environments super spreaders seem to have, super spreading events seem to have happened in, for example. So at this point, it seems to me that, you know, none of this is certain, but it seems pretty reasonable to me to open up outdoor spaces. I think that it was an overreaction to shut down vast stretches of beaches, state parks, where people were really going to be pretty spread out and outdoors. On the other hand, it looks like it was a tremendous mistake to force nursing homes to take patients discharged from the hospital back into nursing homes. We had tremendous spread in nursing homes. It seems like where we've had the most mortality. It seems to me like it would be crazy to open up practice for large choirs, right? We've already seen choirs that seem to be super spreading events, perhaps because people were singing and expelling a lot of air and spit and standing close to each other. That seems like a really bad idea. I think it would be a really bad idea to open up NBA arenas where people are packed in and yelling and screaming, right? So there are some things where it seems like, yeah, that would be a terrible idea right now, at least pending we know more. And see, you know, there are other things. If we're going to be allowing people to go into the supermarket, for example, if the New York City subway system, of all things, is still going to be open, then does it really make sense to close every beach in Los Angeles County? I don't think it does. And I don't want to say that public health officials were just dumb to do all of these things. We just didn't have very much information. Now we do have more information. And some things that seemed smart before, like closing down outdoor spaces, seem like they're probably unnecessary. And some things that seemed unnecessary before, like widespread mask use indoors, seem like they make a lot more sense now, given the information that's filtering out from all around the world.
What you're talking about now is sort of the idea of a limited reopening, and I know that a number of states are you know, doing just that, including the state where I am sitting right now in Utah, you know, moving our coronavirus risk levels to a lower level and allowing some limited opening. The title of your article, again, though, Connor, is Take the Shutdown Skeptics Seriously, and there are some out there who are calling for a complete and immediate reopening. You know, you wrap up your article saying that these facts may not be evident from the least thoughtful proponents of reopening, many of whom advance arguments that are uninformed, dismissive of experts, or callous. But the warnings of thoughtful shutdown skeptics warrant careful study, not stigma rooted in the false pretense that they don't have any plausible concerns or value human life. I mean, is the gist of your article that people are being too dismissive of those who are calling for the kind of complete reopening or who are skeptical of these public health officials?
You know, it really depends on how they're calling for the reopening. You know, if someone is, I think that media coverage of protests tends to focus on some of the dumbest things out there. You know, if you're a photographer out there and you see a sign that just seems, oh, that's definitely wrong, it's hard not to take a picture of that sign. It's hard for readers not to look at that sign. And so a question I always ask people who are skeptical of the shutdowns and who advocate different forms of reopening is, what do you expect to happen? What trade-offs, you know, make explicit. Don't just say, oh, these shutdowns are so stupid. If we open things up, do you expect to see no uptick in deaths, a small uptick in deaths? Give me your estimate for a week and 2 weeks and 3 weeks out, because we can tweak things as we go. It's not as if we are ever locked into exactly what we do at a given moment. I'm much more interested in this, in the shutdown skeptics who say, look at this specific cost that we could be incurring. This is something we might really want to avoid. And whether that is, you know, a crisis in state and local budgets, whether it's a kind of factory that shuts down that's very hard to start up because the supply chains go away, you know, I want a specific account of what they're worried about and why. And we can evaluate that a lot better than the kind of just broad, oh, this is ridiculous. Because I don't think the shutdowns are ridiculous. They may be right, they may be wrong. They're a plausible attempt to answer a very difficult question. And I get frustrated by people on any side of the debate who point to one wrong thing on the other side and say, oh, we just can dismiss them totally, because who among us has gotten everything right on this from the beginning, right? It's just, we haven't seen anything like this in the world for 100 years. And so, of course, we're muddling through as best we can.
Yeah, and hopefully muddling through to the point of having a vaccine and a way out of it. Connor Friedersdorf is a staff writer with The Atlantic, who published an article this week entitled Take the Shutdown Skeptics Seriously. This is not a straightforward battle between a pro-human and a pro-economy camp. Connor Friedersdorf, thanks very much for making time today.
Yeah, thank you.
So a call for a bit more tolerance there. Recognize there's a lot we don't know, and don't demonize the people who may have a different perspective than you, especially if there's some thoughtful analysis behind their argument. Of course, lives are also at stake here.
Convincing people to behave a certain way is exactly what many public health officials are trying to do to hopefully check the spread of the virus, which, as state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn said at the top of the show, is working here in Utah. Speaking of Dr. Dunn, yesterday I asked her about Utah's long-term plan for addressing the pandemic, about the state's end game.
Is the sort of end game from the state's perspective just the development of a vaccine? Is that what stops the pandemic cold in its tracks at this point? Or is there another option for halting the spread of coronavirus?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple options, right? They all are around building herd immunity. We're not going to be able to prevent disease effectively until 60 to 80% of the population is immune to COVID-19. And that happens one of two ways. Either people get infected or they get a vaccine. And we have such low prevalence here in Utah with COVID-19. I mean, my guess is we're less than 5%. We're doing studies now to more accurately predict that. But we are far away from having herd immunity due to everybody being infected. So we are looking towards that vaccine to be able to provide stability in our ability to respond to COVID-19.
But when might we get a vaccine? Under normal circumstances, a vaccine, when it is successfully developed, can take years to bring to market. With a huge push, health officials say that after a significantly sped up process, we could maybe potentially see a vaccine come through in 12 to 18 months. Conceivably, that's 10 to 16 months at this point in the process. In any case, I don't know about you, but I'm trying to get comfortable with not knowing what the future holds and hoping for the best. So what do you think about the measures that are being taken here in Utah and around the country? Are you happy to do your part? Concerned about what's not being considered? As always, we want to hear from you. Weigh in at KCBW's Facebook page, where we will shortly post this show. You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCBW, a listener-supported, independent public radio resource. Subscribe to our podcast for more coverage of this crisis, and even some lighter content from time to time, I promise. I'm Roger McDonough. Hope you're staying safe. Join us again next week.